Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
So it's time now for our Friday gathering. This week I'm joined in the studio by Colin Brophy, Fine Gael TD for Dublin South West, Cian O'Callaghan, Deputy Leader of the Social Democrats and a TD for Dublin Bay North, Christina Finn, Political Editor with The Journal, and Alan Barrett, CEO of the ESRI. And you're all welcome. Thank you for being here. So let's start with what took place on Mount Street earlier this week. The asylum applicants who had been living in the tents there, they were then moved to City West and to Cruxling. 200 tents dismantled and the people were taken by bus and by taxi in some cases to the other sites. So Colm, I'll start with you on this, because the Taoiseach said the camp had been unsafe and illegal, but now we have people who have nowhere to stay, and we have had tents popping up in St Mary's Park and Balls Bridge, people we have heard sleeping on the beach down at Sandy Mount, and there seems to be a real struggle now with accommodation again and already. So it points to the absence of a plan to deal with the people who are coming on a daily basis.
Well, there is a very detailed plan and there is a very detailed set of actions being taken all the time. But there is no question of trying to get around of the fact that the numbers are an issue and the provision of accommodation has been an issue. It has been an issue for some time, which is why the tent situation arose in the first place. But I think there is an obligation on all of us to work to ensure that there is accommodation made available and that there is emergency support in the absence of proper accommodation being made available. But there's also an obligation to have a clear situation where if you have something that is like a tent village in Mount Street, that is not allowed to persist. But it is a combination, I believe, of asking the state to make every effort to provide accommodation, as they have been doing, by the way, between Cruxling, between City West, between the rollout of everything. And there is ongoing new plans in terms of the tender process that's been put in place for new larger reception centres. So that is all taking place, and it's a matter of trying to manage that against the numbers coming in.
Cian, what do you say to what we're seeing? These new arrivals are arguably in a worse position now because they're not there in numbers in Mount Street. They're not being handed the tents when they arrive as they were. I know some of the NGOs have been giving them tents, but we read this morning that in Balls Bridge, some of the residents were helping them by supplying cardboard to put on the ground so that they wouldn't get wet overnight in that park.
Yeah, I think the response actually has been shambolic. There isn't actually emergency support for a number of people who've been left sleeping rough. There was people sleeping in Mount Street in tents that went to get a shower that morning or went to get some food, had no notice that there was alternative accommodation being provided, came back to Main Street, found that their possessions were gone, the tent they were sleeping in was gone, they were left with absolutely nothing, not given any access to any form of outdoor accommodation, and literally left with no possessions and no shelter and on the street. There wasn't emergency support provided for them. They were given a sheet with the names of some voluntary organisations, some of which get zero state support or public funding at all. And that was the level of state support that they were given, you know, nothing. So that's a shambolic.
Where can these people go? What is the answer today?
Well, I think firstly, it's to move people out of those tents to other locations and not to do any form of communication, to actually lift away people's possessions and tents when they're gone for an hour or two, provide them with nothing as an alternative, I think is completely not on. That isn't a kind of approach that should be taken. And yes, you know, in terms of providing basic accommodation and planning for that, that does need to be done. I was talking to a provider of emergency accommodation for asylum seekers yesterday, who already provides accommodation and has a number of empty rooms and empty beds in the accommodation they provide. The department keeps on telling them there's no requirement for them. So they're not using that capacity.
Why might that be happening, Colm?
I don't know. I hear these anecdotal stories all the time being said by various people, and yet though all the indications seem to be that every single bed capacity is being used.
Well, there's this suspicion that this is being used as a deterrent. You know,
no, I don't.
I
don't think that is the case at all, that it's been used as a deterrent. I think what it is I think it's a firm and proper response to a situation that had developed, particularly on Mount Street, which was non-sustainable and had to be responded to.
But it's just been moved.
What has been done is, in the majority of cases, it was to provide accommodation in other areas and to provide proper, better. It's not perfect accommodation. I mean, people have to realise we are talking about emergency.
But even if you accept that is better, it doesn't solve the problem in any way for the new arrivals who are coming. They have nowhere to go.
There is a constant requirement to source and acquire new accommodation to deal with new people coming in. And that is what Roger O'Gorman and the government have been dealing with collectively. And that's why you have this process now of looking to do the enlarged centres, which the tenders have been announced for, which will go out with a view to try to deal with this. But it's also why you deal with it on the other side, which is why the migration pact is so important, because the key solution to this is also reducing the numbers that are arriving in and processing those that arrive in a much faster and quicker way.
OK, Alan Barrett, what have you got to say about all of this and about what happened this week?
Well, I mean, clearly the situation that has developed is tremendously unfortunate, but I'm not sure we necessarily need to blame anybody domestically. Just to put it in context, the fundamental problem here is that the number of asylum seekers arriving in Europe generally has been increasing dramatically over the last 5 or 6 years. And even if you compare 2022 to 2023, the numbers were up about 20%. OK, so there's a sort of an international challenge, and that's why the British are dealing with it, the French, the Italians. All countries are dealing with this enormously difficult challenge. And Ireland is essentially part of that. And not many countries have found a sort of a very straightforward solution. Obviously, in Ireland, we have the additional difficulty then of the housing crisis. I know Keane and other sort of politicians are going to try and make as much of this as possible. But really, this is a logistical issue for civil servants. I mean, as we speak, there are people in various government departments, especially in the Department of Integration, who are really working feverishly to try and house as many people as possible. There is a group of people that they haven't managed to house, but there's that huge group of people that they actually have managed to house.
But this isn't a surprise. Like Catherine Day said some time ago, you need to build 6 centres. Then she revised her report and said you need to build up to 13.
Well,
we don't have one of them.
No, but in fairness, the problem is getting bigger every year. OK, and it's almost like in the same way the housing crisis gets bigger every year because the population is growing all the time and it just gets more and more.
But if you don't
difficult.
Do anything to address the problem, of
well,
course,
I think
it's going to get
I think
bigger.
There is. But I mean, in terms of, well, again, there's plenty of activity to try and solve the housing crisis. But if we can just go, I think the policy lever that the government has to hand that they can probably implement most quickly is around the acceleration of processing times. I mean, the difficulty is that you have a build up of people waiting for asylum in all conditions when the system isn't working fast enough. So, I mean, there's two important things that we need to have. We need the process to be speeded up, OK? Now, on the one hand, that means if you decide somebody can't stay, they will be deported, and that's not very, very pleasant, but that's the way the law works. But we need to do that quickly. But on a more positive perspective, if we can get processing times increased for people who are then given refugee status, they can start integrating in a positive way into Irish society. And in a sense, then, the biggest way to sort of reduce the asylum seeker numbers is to either deport on the one hand or absorb and integrate on the other. Okay, and really, like, we're not going to be able to build loads of houses overnight, but we probably have a much better capacity to sort of, you know, expand. And again, this is happening, but to expand the numbers of people in that.
Well, that comes back to housing again, because we know that there are people in direct provision centres who've been granted asylum, but they have nowhere to go.
But it is also important just to note on your point that we have actually substantially speeded up that process. So that process, which was taking over a year, is now down to taking, in some instances, just a couple of months. Okay. And the reason and the difference that makes, as you quite correctly address, is that either it allows people the certainty to move on with their life, having been deemed to be genuine, or else it enables the deportation notice to be served.
OK, Christina Finn wants to come in there. Go ahead,
yeah,
Christina.
I just think the migration issue now is very much front and centre, I think, in any of the Irish political discourse. And we've seen the government, I think, running from crisis to crisis on it. I think the point has to be made, the optics weren't great with Main Street. It was there for a very long time. So the fact that a decision was just made suddenly on this, I think, has to come down to a factor that there is a deterrent issue here. We've seen it happen before with ministers coming out, putting warnings out that have been, you know, passed on to other European counterparts in other countries that, you know, were running out of accommodation, that were under severe pressure. But look, I think, you know, after we had the Mount Street camp cleared, we had the statement come out from the Taoiseach saying that the laws of the land must always be upheld and we can't have unsafe and illegal encampments on our cities and our towns. And you've seen that narrative, I think, play out over the last number of days. What, if someone can point to me what the law of the land in terms of asylum seekers who are given tents by NGOs and by official agencies, and they use those tents to set up wherever they could, and suddenly that is no longer acceptable. And to be given sheets of paper to say that if they return to the site that they could possibly face arrest. Like that, there is no planning in terms of how that was going to play out. Yes, they were given accommodation. We had Roderick O'Gorman on the radio during the week saying, you know, they were given the option of accommodation. Like, let's call a spade here. You know what I mean? They were asked, they were told to move on and they were bussed out of the area. And if they didn't find that accommodation, it was almost like a bit of a good luck to you. And they've ended up in different areas around the city. And that's where we are today.
So you're saying all of this is to send out a message to people who might be intending on coming to Ireland?
We have seen that play out before in the last number of months when the accommodation has been drying up, that there has been concerted messages translated out to other agencies to deter the numbers from coming in. And it has actually worked in some you know, instances where the numbers have fallen down from different countries. But yesterday we did have the Cabinet Subcommittee on Migration meet with, you know, the Justice Minister and Simon Harris were there, and there was a whole array of topics touched on. One of them as well was the communications plan. Like, we've been talking about that for the last year. Like, Leo Varadkar was up in the Dáil, I think, 14 months ago, saying that politicians needed to find the language to discuss migration, because over a year ago, you couldn't even get a politician
to
talk
to. Well, we had Joe O'Brien, the Green Party Minister of State, on here last week, saying that he's been looking for that plan as well, and he's really frustrated that there's no sign of it.
Yeah, my understanding was it was being worked on the Department of Taoiseach for a number of months, and it was meant to explain the processes, the numbers, and, you know, also to highlight that migration is a good thing in terms of the thousands of workers that are here in our health, tech sector, pharma centre that are being lumped in with this whole narrative and rhetoric that's really, really divisive. And there is a concern, I understand from that meeting yesterday, that there was a concern that this was going to have an impact on the workers that we so badly need here, that are being, you know, targeted within this conversation of asylum seekers, refugees, migration issue, and what impact that actually might have on our workforce. So I do think there needs to be a body of work. To be honest, I think the horse has bolted with a communications plan at this stage. It should have been rolled out when we had, you know, the Ukrainians arriving, and, you know, that two-tier system, I suppose, of international protection applicants and the Ukrainian refugees, which hasn't helped.
The opportunity has been lost, Colin, with that communications plan.
No, I don't accept that at all, because I think, first of all, part of what we're seeing is a very strong impetus and very good decision-making by the new Taoiseach in terms of addressing this issue and pushing it front and centre. I think he wants to do that and wants to be very clear on what we should do. Whether we have a communications plan that may be late, but it is better to get it up and going.
But
migration is an issue.
But
that's why you that's why you don't throw your hands up at it, and actually why it's important that government communicate more and more on this. Because I would agree with your point, and it is a very central point, that we have within our country, we have hundreds of thousands of people who are contributing incredibly.
Okay.
And the tone of what we've seen over the last 12 months particularly must be very, very upsetting and disconcerting for them.
Alan Barr, do you want to come in?
Yeah, no, just to say, I mean, we colleagues in the Institute published a report about 2 months ago which showed that it is still the case that Irish people are overwhelmingly positively disposed towards immigration. So, you know, the notion that in some sense a communications gap, I mean, you know, clearly there is a group of people who are very very exercised about this. There's, you know, rather dark forces, and there are people with genuine concerns. But if you actually look at the data, Ireland remains one of the most positive immigration attitude countries in Europe. Small dip in recent times, but we're still
facing outliers. Into local and European elections where it is coming up at the doorstep.
It might be coming up at the doorstep, but all I'm saying is the data. Okay, if you take a representative sample and you know get attitudes towards immigration, we're still very, very positive.
And I think that is the case. But the problem is because of the way this has been handled now over the last year or so, you know, for example, in my constituency, there's an area that's very ethnically diverse. There's a huge amount of people with different skills working in different sectors. And there was, up until about a year ago, everything in that area was working very well. But since then, certainly people in the area are complaining to me that there is targeting and abuse of migrants coming from a certain section there, that wasn't happening because there's been too much opportunities for, you know, people who are trying to exploit these issues to be able to, you know, too many opportunities created for them to be able to do that. I think not having, you know, properly state-run accommodation that has been recommended, not having that set up, then creates, there's been this over-reliance in the private sector, then that creates divisions within communities, you
and
know.
I have to pick up on that because in my constituency and within my community, I have seen people who were exploiting that type of division and wanting to have that long before this migrant crisis developed. And it is, unfortunately, and I know the empirical data may be there or whatever, but there are sections of people who deliberately go out of their way to ferment anger and annoyance. They don't need a particular issue. They'll do it, and they have been doing it. And we've seen it in, which you've, I know, covered on your show, actually, you know, just over a year ago, you know, particular communities experiencing, say, on public transport, experiencing real harassment and difficulty. And we must call that out all the time.
I'm conscious of the time, and I just want to move on to another topic which has been in the news, and that is the triple lock around why, where and when Irish troops should go and serve. What's the Social Democrats' policy on this one, Cian?
Well, we'd like to see the triple lock kept in place. We don't think the government have put forward a convincing case at all for changing it. We don't think there's been good public discussion around it. I think the Irish Defence Forces have a very good record of what they've done internationally in terms of peacekeeping. And part of the reason they've been able to play the role that they have is because we don't have the kind of associations that other militaries have as well.
Doesn't that mean then that Russia and China have a say over what we decide to do with our troops?
Well, in terms of the veto, for example, it's been there for, you know, it's not a new thing.
But the world has changed.
No, it has. But the country that's exercised the veto most has been the United States. And that isn't talked about. And actually, they've exercised the veto a lot in terms of Palestine in particular. But what the government are proposing to do is to get rid of the safeguards that we have in place now. And they're not proposing any other safeguards. So if they feel that is problematic, why not talk about alternative safeguards? But they're not doing that. They're saying we just want a free hand here to be able to send troops on whatever missions, wherever, under any circumstances.
Is that what you're saying, Colm?
No, it's not at all. I mean, look, I appreciate it for a tight on time just to be... You hit it on the head, actually, in the way you described it with Russia. But it's actually Vladimir Putin. I mean, you can do a bit of sleight of hand and say America's exercised the veto a lot. But whether it's America, whether it's Vladimir Putin, whether it's the Chinese... I've had the opportunity to see firsthand the way the Security Council is effectively now, in my opinion, maybe a bit bluntly, but dysfunctional and does not work. We lived through a period of time immediately after the end of the Cold War where we had probably the most effective and functioning UN, but we don't have any more.
OK, but if we want to remove it, what safeguards would be in place?
I think we have a triple lock. I mean, we'd certainly look to make sure that we have that. The other locks in place that we would have, the consent, obviously, in terms of... But what we're looking at here, and remember this, is peacekeeping, is using our defence forces to actually engage in a situation where we as a small country, and it's one of the things we do most effectively and that our you know, defence forces have done incredibly effectively, which is to be able to be deployed to go to areas and to be available. So, you know, in a situation where you have maybe something in a post-war, hopefully, situation in somewhere where you can have defence forces.
Yeah, but people link this with neutrality. That is the problem,
isn't it,
Christina?
But that's a false link.
But this is what people do.
Politicians who want to try it.
Yeah, it is linked between the neutrality thing, because that's so embedded, I think, in Irish people and the way we feel about where we stand on certain issues. And look, I think when they're talking about the triple lock and the UN Security Council, you know, the push was sort of surprising, I think, when Micheál Martin first came out with it, when was questioning that this was going to be done away with, because I think the feeling in Leinster House and even among the public was that there needed to be more of a discourse or discussion about this. We had the security conference there in Dublin Castle, but, you know, not many people are tuning in to a conference online to watch the future of their triple lock and their defence. There needs to be, I think, more of a wider discourse. And there was talk about that Citizens' Assembly. Mm. Perhaps that would have been a better option and got everyone a bit more engaged, where there would have been a lot more coverage rather than just 4 days of a bit of a discussion about what we want to do. And now we're facing into pushing ahead with legislation.
Well, Cian, you've been accused now there of stirring this up.
Well, I'm not trying to stir anything up, but look, the onus is on the government if they want to do a very fundamental change. I mean, when the Irish Army was set up, they actually weren't allowed to serve abroad at all until they started with those UN peacekeeping mandates. And the reason they've been so effective, if you talk to people who've served in those mandates, and they will tell you how the Irish Army is much more effective than other military forces, because they have such a good reputation of not getting involved in the kind of militarised conflicts that a lot of other European countries have. And we shouldn't be risking that role that they're able to play. It's a very, very positive role. Okay. Government are saying, just give us a free hand on this.
Okay, I want to give a quick word from Alan Barrett before we...
I have no expertise, so I'll talk about it as a citizen rather than an economist or anything else. When Cian sort of talks about safeguards, I guess as a citizen, what I don't understand about the objection to moving back from the triple lock is, I mean, surely we trust our elected parliament. I mean, we elect our parliament to make all sorts of laws, all sorts of decisions on our behalf. We don't sort of say we're going to elect them, but we're going to get an outside international agency to oversee what they're doing. And I just think when it's something as fundamental as that, we should trust our elected government.
That makes sense, Cian, doesn't it?
Yeah, what we've always done as a country, and I think most people support, is that we serve under United Nations mandates. We don't serve under NATO-led operations. It's United Nations, and we've always believed in that as a country. It's very fundamental to our international approach. I don't want to see situation arise where government of the day could decide, right, we'll serve under a NATO-led operation. And you're not proposing any safeguards at all to prevent that happening.
What I don't want to see arise is the situation, unfortunately, where we can't send our defence forces because of this triple lock.
All right, my time is up. We'll be put out if I don't stop soon. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming in. That's it for today. The programme was produced by Ronan Coveney. Series producer is Niamh Lyons. Research by Amy Ryan. Today, our broadcast coordinator is Michelle Gibson, and James Feeney was on sound. Have a lovely bank holiday weekend.